You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
This episode is brought to you by FX's The Veil, starring Elizabeth Moss. FX's The Veil is an international spy thriller that follows two women as they play a deadly game of truth and lies on the road from Istanbul to Paris and London. One woman has a secret, and the other has a mission to reveal it before thousands of lives are lost. FX's The Veil, now streaming, only on Hulu.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome, 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 friend. I'm TK, your tour guide to the past, and you are listening to For the Love of History, the podcast where we talk about world history, women's history, weird history, and we are now the author interview podcast as well, which I'm very, very excited about and so fortunate that so many amazing authors have reached out to the podcast. And we have today a very special author that I met on TikTok, of all places. We have Amanda Schiavo, and I'm so excited to have her on to talk about her book, which is a topic we almost never cover here on the podcast, Mary Tudor. Tudor history is not my forte at all. There are some people that do it amazingly, so I'm really excited to have Amanda on the podcast today. Thank you for joining us, Amanda.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm so excited.
Me too. So I met Amanda virtually, and I was scrolling one day on TikTok, scrolling on TikTok one day and came across this lady in a beautiful costume, which you can see if you're watching the YouTube version, you can see it in the background right there. Saw her in this gorgeous costume, and I was like, oh my goodness, who is this woman who is just cosplaying her heart out? And it ended up being Amanda. And Amanda ended up being an author, and she's also a journalist, by the way, writing a book called In Her Own Right, about Mary Tudor, kind of giving a spotlight to Mary Tudor herself. And Amanda, I would love it if you told us more about your book, In Her Own Right.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, again, thank you so much for having me, and I'm super excited to be here to chat about it. So yeah, In Her Own Right is a novel of the Lady Mary Tudor. So that is Queen Mary I of England. And the novel takes place on her journey from princess to bastard to queen. Ooh. And Mary herself has this reputation. She is known, not many people might know the name Mary Tudor, but they definitely have heard the name Bloody Mary. That's who we're talking about today. And Mary has a reputation because there were significant religious persecutions during her reign. She has sort of gotten this legend of Bloody Mary, and we can definitely talk into more about where that comes from later on. But as far as the book goes, I've always been a fan of Tudor history. I've always been a fan of Tudor fiction. And one of my favorite Tudor authors is Alison Weir. I love her book. She's so awesome. And, you know, I'm always looking for my next read. And there's not many novels about Mary herself. She's usually like a side character, sort of a background character. Or if it's, you know, in the context of her sister Elizabeth, she's often the villain. And so writing the book really just came from a desire to read a book about her.
That's awesome.
That was like a little bit more balanced and a little bit more nuanced, not one that is erasing the things that happened, but kind of giving an explanation as to where it came from and who she was, and kind of understanding that bloody moniker really isn't justifiably given to her. There's definitely, if you look at it in the context of her father, Henry VIII should probably be the one being called bloody.
Yeah, Bloody Henry. It doesn't roll off the tongue as well as Bloody Mary, but you know, He also was not the best from my very limited knowledge of Tudor history. So I'm sure there's other history BFFs out there that are not really familiar with Tudor history. So could you tell us a little bit more about where Mary falls in this whole big Tudor shenanigan situation?
So Mary is the second to last monarch of the Tudor dynasty. There are five. Okay. There is Henry VII, who famously defeated Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth. There is Henry VIII, and we all know him. After Henry VIII comes Edward VI, Henry's, you know, long desired son, who rules for about 6 years and then dies very, very young. And then after Edward comes Mary. And it sounds like it should have been a very smooth and simple succession, but it wasn't, because of all of the religious turmoil that bubbles up during Henry's reign. He breaks with the Roman Catholic Church. Protestantism starts to bubble to the surface. Henry had always really been more Catholic, but just wanted to be in charge of the church himself. But his sort of schism kind of gave Protestants almost like a starting gun, and they just kind of started slowly kind of moving in and kind of, you know, being more comfortable to practice their religion that was once persecuted. And so Edward, as a young boy, is raised by his Protestant uncles, and he becomes king. He is, you know, very much, he's 9 years old, but he's very much of the mind that Catholicism is wrong. The Pope is, you know, the devil. Idolatry, prayers for the dead, all these different things are just not what good Christian people do. So he starts to outlaw basically Catholicism as a whole. Oh. Mary, on the other hand, his elder sister, is a devout Catholic. She had been Catholic. Her mother was Catherine of Aragon, the daughter of Queen Isabella of Spain and King Ferdinand. I should correct that. Queen Isabella of Castile and King Ferdinand of Aragon, who united Spain at one point. So she was raised from a very young age to believe that the Pope could do no wrong, that Catholicism was the way to go. You know, you needed to say your prayers for the dead to help get them into heaven. And you had to, you know, she attended mass daily, sometimes, you know, several times a day. She believed that the mass needed to be said in Latin and that the Bible wasn't for everybody to read. So she was very, very, very Catholic. And especially when her father she was about 10 years old when her father decides he's divorcing her mother, wants to marry Lynn, is breaking from the church. So at 10 years old, your whole world is being thrown upside down. You've got your mother on one side fighting for her right as queen and for Mary's right as the heir. You've got your other side saying, my marriage is invalid, my child is a bastard, the Pope is wrong, everything you know is wrong. So Mary is just thrown for this loop, and she really, really digs her heels into her faith. Her faith is the one constant thing in her life. So when her younger brother is dying and he realizes how sick he is, you know, he was too young to have been married or have any children of his own. So by the law, Mary was the next person to inherit the throne. Edward and his advisors were terrified that Mary was going to undo all of their Protestant works and reestablish Catholicism, which was her goal. So what they said to you is...
They were rightly afraid.
They were rightly afraid. You knew what she was coming to do.
Like, oh, no.
So what they decide to do is leave the throne to somebody else. Now, Edward and Mary have a sister, Elizabeth, who goes on to become Queen Elizabeth I, but she wasn't the right candidate at the time. She wasn't going to betray her sister. She was also what they would have called dubious parentage. So... The next legitimate person in line for the throne would have been Edward and Mary's cousin, Lady Jane Grey. And she's known as the 9-Day Queen because Edward decides to name her queen in his will. She very reluctantly becomes queen. She accepts it, even though she says, this isn't right. I'm not meant to be queen. It is meant to be Mary. All of the men kind of around her, like, no, you're doing this because you're a Protestant and you're devout and we're going to control you. But Mary was not going to take that line down. And Mary leads one of the only, if not the only, or at least one of the only bloodless coups to overthrow a government in English history. She rallies the troops. the Navy is on her side, and she takes back her kingdom, she takes back her throne. When a lot of people did not expect her to be able to do it, she had a lot of powerful cousins, especially on her mother's side, being, you know, a descendant of Spain. Her cousin was the Holy Roman Emperor. Another cousin was the regent in the Netherlands. So she had a lot of powerful European.
Just like name drop.
Yeah, she really could.
Emperor.
So many powerful royal cousins who really were just kind of like, I don't think this girl is going to pull this off, so we're not really going to do much about it. So it was her and it was the people of England who put her on the throne. And she was so, so, so popular when she became queen. And unfortunately, at the end of her reign, it was the complete and total opposite of that. Mm-hmm. I feel like I went on such a long tangent. I don't know if I answered your question.
No, you did. You did. You very much answered the question. I think that is one of the most concise, understandable explanations of that Tudor history, that era, that I have ever had. Wonderful. Like there's so many moving parts of Tudor history, and then so many people have the same name, and so many people married the same person with the same name. And it is overwhelming.
I'm sure somebody listening is going to go, wait, she didn't mention this and she didn't mention that.
It's fine. We do not have those types of people in the History BFF Club, okay?
Love it.
My brain has a really hard time switching off at night, so I really like to listen to calming things before I go to bed, and I've recently started listening to Calm History, which is exactly as cool as it sounds. If you want to learn about fascinating moments in history in the most relaxing way possible, then try the new podcast, Calm History. Each episode is narrated in a calm voice to help you relax or fall asleep. The host, Harris, has one of the most soothing voices ever, and you're going to feel like you're in a cozy little bookstore with the fireplace going while a friendly professor talks to you. You'll learn about famous explorers, leaders, inventions, civilizations, and ancient wonders. There is even a 6-part series about the Titanic. Just search your favorite podcast player for Calm History or use the link to calmhistory.com, C-A-L-M, history.com, in the episode notes below. I hope you enjoy Calm History. Now back to the episode.
I'm Jane Perlez, longtime foreign correspondent and former Beijing bureau chief for The New York Times. I've been a foreign correspondent in lots of places, Somalia, Indonesia, Pakistan. But nowhere as important to the world as China.
I mean, China is not dropping anti-democratic paratroopers into Montana. But of course, we did see things like the weather balloon / spy balloon riveting the whole country for a week.
This is Face Off, an 8-part series in which we'll take you behind the scenes to key moments in the tumultuous U.S.-China relationship. We'll speak with a diplomat, a spy, a tech reporter, a U.S. admiral, even Yo-Yo Ma. Plus, my pal and noted China historian Rana Mitter joins the conversation. We'll look at what's driving the two nations apart and explore whether anything can help bring them back together. Face Off launches April 9th.
So, okay, we've got Mary. She's a strong, independent woman going in there. Bloodless coup, very excited, getting her Catholicism on. How does she go from all of this to like the whole idea that basically she's a vampire killing a bunch of people and like bathing in people's blood?
Is somebody that, else. That's not Mary.
Is that somebody else?
That's not Mary. That? No. That is another woman whose name I cannot remember.
No, exactly.
I know exactly who you're talking about. I cannot for the life of me remember her name, but it's not Mary. Although I wouldn't be surprised if somebody started that rumor about her at some point. So, because I mean, they just dragged that girl's name through the mud.
Oh my gosh.
She does. She goes from being this beloved queen to, in 5 very short years, to being thought of as a tyrant. And that's why the name of the book is In Her Own Right. She is the first woman to rule England in her own right. If Mary doesn't take back the throne from Jane and the faction that, it's not fair to say from Jane because it was the faction the Northumberland mm-hmm. faction that put Jane on. I mean, Jane was a child. She was 16. She was a baby. So Mary is the first person to rule England in her own right. The first woman to rule England in her own right. And if we don't have Mary, we don't get Elizabeth. We don't mm-hmm. get any, and we don't get any of the women who follow. There are six women who rule England in her own right. And we don't get any of them if it's not for Mary, because she proved that you could do this, that female rule works.
Yeah.
Yeah, because there were
It does.
I mean, there was one possible male heir. His last name is Courtney. I believe it's pronounced. I'm not gonna get too much into him because I don't know a lot about him. He's like a cousin of this one or that one. So there was a possibility that he maybe could have possibly, even that like gets kind of swept under the rug. The only by the time of Edward's death, the only legitimate people with claims to the throne, the only people with legitimate claims to the throne are women, which is just so
cool.
And yes, that's why the name of the book is In Her Own Right. And I choose with the book to end it on Mary's moment of triumph. I am working on the sequel, which is going to cover her reign, but I just felt like Mary really deserved that moment of triumph. And we go from Mary the Queen, who, you know, had a troubled life, who, you know, did some things during her reign that were very tragic, to this myth of Bloody Mary. There were about, in the 5 years that Mary was queen, about 300 people are burned at the stake for heresy. Mm-hmm. And heresy being, you know, not following the correct religion. And at that point, Mary, it's Catholicism. Mm-hmm. At the beginning, Mary and her advisors did not believe they were going to burn as many people as they did. They thought it was going to be more of a lesson, more of a deterrent. But Protestantism sort of started to develop as this rebellious sort of move against the government. So the more that they burned, the more people stood up and said, we're not going to stand for this. I will proudly go to my death as a Protestant, you know. So it really sort of became this sort of back and forth kind of thing. Well, we'll just burn more people and then they'll stop. And it's like, well, they're going to burn more people, so we might as well keep going. So I think everyone kind of has this view of Mary as like skipping off to the different pyres and like lighting them herself. Really did not
the imagery
that. She really did not expect to use that as the tool that it ended up becoming. But the legend of Bloody Mary actually doesn't start until the next century or after the Jacobean era, because by that point, Protestantism was so ingrained in English culture. It was who they were as people that anything Catholic was seen as, you know, just wrong and we don't want anything to do with this. And what better way to make Catholicism seem evil than have the last Catholic monarch, and let's take her and turn her into this monster.
No.
That's really where the Bloody Mary myth came from. And it's so interesting to compare her to the other Tudors, because it's estimated that Henry VIII, in the 40 plus years that he was on the throne, executed anywhere between 52,000 and 72,000 people.
Good Lord.
Yeah.
That's like twice the size of the city that I live in right now. Yeah. That's insane.
Yes.
Oh my goodness.
We even in our little TikTok that we do together, mentioned that bloody and gruesome deaths are the norm in that era. And Henry, he was a fan of the traitor's death. He was hanging you, he was cutting you down, he was splashing cold water on your face to wake you up so that you felt that disembowelment coming.
Stop it.
Mm-hmm. And then you were right? And I'm not, again, I don't know if anyone's gonna give me any flack for this, but sometimes when people were burned at the stake, what other people would do is they would hide gunpowder underneath the sort of, I don't know what you call it, kindling, so that flame hit
the pyre, whatever
flame hit, that you were gone. If I had a choice, maybe
quicker is better. I mean, burning at the stake or kind of getting shot.
Yeah.
This one over here. I'm team getting shot other than burning at the stake. Thanks very much.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And Henry, another thing that Henry did was he had somebody boiled alive. They poisoned somebody at his court and he felt like they needed, because a lot of, there was rumors that it was Anne Boleyn's family who did it, that we could go into all that kind of thing. But so he was like, I'm going to make an example of this person who poisoned these people and I'm going to boil him alive.
And he's just Henry.
And he's just
not, like, he's just
Henry.
Henry. Oh my gosh. That's and not fair.
Not fair at all. And the other thing that drives me crazy, I'm going to go off on a tangent, but stop myself.
Stop off.
The other thing that drives me crazy is with Henry, they make him out to be this sort of like charmer, and the story between him and Anne Boleyn, it was this great love story and that turned tragic. And it's like, no, it was never a love story. She literally hid away in the country for a year to get away from this man. Love stories don't typically one person decapitating another.
Yeah.
So a lot of, but again, that idea just goes back to that sort of Jacobean, Protestantism is who we are. Mm-hmm. So we're going to vilify this person. And then of course she had the misfortune of being a woman. So easy target.
How very dare she, dare she be born a woman.
Right.
Gosh. So we have this smear campaign basically. Mm-hmm. Against Mary. And that's where all of these rumors of Bloody Mary come from. Mm-hmm. And is that, do you talk about that in your book as well?
Not in, this is so funny because I was actually just working on it last night. So I don't want to give like too many spoils away, but not in this book. I what I try to do in this book is showcase the trauma that she went through so you can understand the kind of fucked up person she becomes. There's no other way to put it. I mean, she becomes a very fucked up person in terms of how she deals with people, you know, Protestants. Her mental health takes a dive. She experiences, this is not something that I explore in the novel that's out, but I'm trying to figure out how to write it now for my sequel. She experiences two phantom pregnancies. Yeah. Wow. And so that just takes a toll on her as well. Because the truth of the matter is, all this girl ever really wanted was a husband and a family. She really,
poor thing.
Her father kept her unmarried for a very long time because of who she was on her mother's side. It would have been very easy for any husband to overthrow Henry and say, well, I don't say very easy. It would have been plausible for
possibility.
For a husband, anyone that married, to try and overthrow Henry, and then when Henry died, not try and overthrow Edward in the name of Mary.
Oh my gosh, poor thing.
Henry was afraid of his daughter. At least
I mean, holy cow. It seems like she held a lot of chips for the monarchy, but also was mistreated really, really bad, and then turned into, I don't want to say justifiably a monster,
right?
But like,
you can't justify, you know,
you can't justify murdering 300 people.
You can understand who the human being was.
Yes. Yeah. So, that makes her story make a lot more sense. Not saying that like she's the next, you know, Time Magazine Woman of the Year, but the context is important, definitely important. Mm-hmm. So in your book, as a person who is not very well versed in the Tudorverse, is it a pretty, you know, easily digestible read? Like if I have no knowledge of the Tudors, I could like dive in and be totally fine.
Absolutely, for sure. It's a breezy read. It actually ended up coming out much shorter than I expected it to.
Okay.
And for a little while, I was kind of down on myself about that. But then I just chalked it up to my training as a journalist. You know, my job is to get to the point. So
that's That's what we like here. Here on For the Love of History, we are get to the point people. I mean, we don't ever have episodes longer than, I think the longest we ever did is like 45 minutes, maybe 50. Mm-hmm. And that's like once in the last almost 4 years. So we are very to the point people here. So with this book, how was your research process? Where did you go? What did you do to find your research on this book?
Well, what was fun actually is, so this was actually my major in college. So I had a ton of my old like history textbooks to reference. And then I also just like to read Tudor nonfiction in my spare time. So I actually have just a ton of books on my shelf about the era just in general. So I turned to the books and I made sure that I was using the research of historians who were coming at it balanced, because there are, you know, everyone has their favorite. There's definitely someone who's more biased about this person or more biased about that person, or isn't a fan of this person or isn't a fan of that person. So it was just really important to make sure that I was doing research that involved a lot of context and a lot of primary sources. And actually, one of the main books that I used for my research, what is called Mary Tudor by Anna Whitelock.
Okay.
Which is just a great, it's just, if you're interested in just learning about Mary, the person, the facts, I highly, highly recommend that one. So I used that a lot for my research as well. It was really important to me to be as accurate as possible. From a fan perspective, I prefer a novel that is more accurate. These stories really don't need any embellishment.
Yeah.
There were, you know, it's fiction, so I did take some license. I invented a character. I gave Mary a best friend. So I just felt like, I was like, everyone needs a best friend. And so she's a maid in Mary's household who they just become very close, and you know, they go on this journey sort of together. So I just felt like, and then I gave the maid a husband who I also made up. So there's definitely some license. I condensed some things. I cut some things out that weren't really necessary. Yeah. So that's kind of how I approached that.
Awesome. That's great. So there are, it seems like now there are a lot of historical fiction books coming out, you know, in the last year and next year, there's a lot of historical fictions lined up. And I want to know what do you think, what role do historical fictions play in the history world when it comes to history education?
Yeah.
I know there's some people who are like, don't like them very much. I want just like straight facts.
Yeah.
So what is your opinion on that?
My opinion is you have to be very careful with who you read. Like if you like, you know, an author who tends to lean more towards the fiction than the history side, that's great. Go enjoy what you enjoy. Just come at it knowing that it's fiction. Unfortunately, there are some, you know, areas of history that have gotten sort of mingled with fiction. I mean, and it goes back, the whole idea of Richard III having a weathered arm and a hunchback. We have Shakespeare to thank for that. That's not who he was.
I didn't know that.
That is pure Shakespeare propaganda, because Richard III was actually a very, what's the word I'm looking for, skilled fighter. He was a knight. He would have learned swordplay from a very swordplay. He would fight with a sword. What they were not playing back then. He learned how to fight with a sword from a very young age. He fought in many battles. He fought at the Battle of Bosworth, you know. But Shakespeare was writing during Elizabeth's time at the beginning, towards the end of Elizabeth's reign. And Elizabeth is the granddaughter of King Henry VII, the man who defeated Richard at the Battle of Bosworth. So you're writing for her, you're going to make Richard look like a monster. And what better way than to give him a hump and a weathered arm and a limp and just all of these characteristics that are now just associated with Richard that just is simply not true.
Yeah, I do. Like, I remember, again, not an expert on Tudor history or that part of the world, but I do remember watching some documentary somewhere about how they like found him underneath a parking lot or something And they were skeptical if it was him or not, because he didn't have like a hunchback and like a weathered arm.
He did though have scoliosis, that if you go and you watch the documentary, spine is like this perfect S. So wild. Yeah. So that some people think maybe that's where the myth kind of came from. Like somebody, you know, he kind of trickled down through someone who knew him, saw him, he would have had like kind of been a little asymmetrical. Yeah. And then that trickled down. And then Shakespeare was like, hump.
That man has a hump. Oh my gosh. This is the times that remind me that so much of history are just like people being mean and spreading rumors.
They're people. Yeah, that's the thing. They're
people talking shit
with agendas. And I wish I could remember who said this. I was watching something and somebody made a good point about not knowing what history is, but knowing what history isn't. And it isn't a simpler time. It isn't a time when people are more good and genuine. And we've humans collectively, we've always been like this.
Wow, that is so interesting. So in your book, it's a historical fiction. We've got this look of Mary. God, I almost said Anne. We've got this look on Mary. And so in the book, without giving too much away, do we get to see a little bit of Mary's own thoughts and her own feelings?
Yeah.
Okay.
100% from Mary's perspective. And that's something also too, because in with all of these things, you know, if there's somebody else that there's a lot of sort of history propaganda about, and that's Anne Boleyn. You know, I, as a, from a historical standpoint, as a historian, as somebody who studied this, I know what Anne Boleyn's character was more like versus what media has portrayed her as. But with this being Mary's point of view, and wicked stepmother, and is the reason that all of these terrible things happen to her mother. You know, she, again and again, it sounds silly, but this is a very superstitious time. So all these sort of whispers about Anne possibly being a witch in Mary's head, that makes sense, because why else would my father, who loved my mother for 20 years, all of a sudden want to break with the church and declare me a bastard and get divorced and this, that, and that? It must be witchcraft, which to us sounds like, girl, no.
Bananas.
But it's so superstitious in that area that it makes sense to her. So from this, for this perspective, from Mary's perspective, Anne is the villain. One of the villains in the story. But I also, I think I try and do a good job of kind of balancing it out and showing that it is Mary's point of view and not necessarily what Anne was actually like. And I was more focused on Mary's story than Anne's.
Yeah. So it's a, you know, the perspective of a young girl who's having all of this happen to you. And, you know, when you have this stepmother who it seems like it's all that her stepmother's fault, you know, you're going to have a bad image of Anne Boleyn. Okay. Awesome. Great. Oh, Amanda.
Interesting. What I try to do in the story is after Anne's execution, there's a scene in the book where Mary is talking to somebody and she says, "It's over now. My father, you know, he's going to love me again." And, and the person that she's talking to is like, "That's not going to happen." And as with history, Henry does threaten to have her executed if she doesn't conform to what he wants.
Yeah. Oh my gosh, poor thing. Well, at the risk of just revealing everything in the book, thank you so much for coming on today. And I'm so excited about this book. And can you tell everybody where they can find the book, where they can find you?
Absolutely. So the book itself, you can find it in a few different locations directly from the publisher. So that's Black Rose Writing. You can also find it on Amazon, Barnes and Noble. I recently discovered that you can get it on Target. That was a surprise. Yeah, I was like, cool, I'm in Target. So yeah, those are the main places that you can get it from. And I, if you want to keep up with me and all things Mary, you can go to TikTok and follow at AmandaWrites89. I do cosplay. And I started to recently do a few Did You Know about Mary, and you might also see me on the History Hotline as well.
The History Hotline, yes. We got some things cooking up for the History Hotline, which I'm very excited about. So again, thank you so much, Amanda, for coming on, talking about your book In Her Own Right. And if you're out there listening, go check out her book. I'll leave everything Amanda related in the show notes so that you can go find her. Again, thank you so much, Amanda. It was so lovely talking to you.
Thank you so much. I had such a blast.
And I will see you in the outro. Okay, bye. Well, dear one, that is it for episode 120. 21 of For the Love of History podcast. I don't know why I'm talking like this. Thank you so much to Amanda for joining us today and telling us all about her book. Remember, you can buy In Her Own Right
at all of the places linked in the show notes below, and you can also request it through your library. Each library has a different request process, so if you're unsure, just go up, speak to your librarian, they're super friendly people, and ask them how you can request the book, and that is also really helpful to authors. So if you can't buy the book, you can always request it. Because we're all about supporting authors, supporting creators, especially in this Women's History Month. Not especially, because every month it's very important. And speaking of supporting, if you would like to support For the Love of History podcast, it would be great if you could leave a rating and review. Reviews are so, so helpful. They're like little offerings on the altar of the algorithm gods, and the algorithm gods just eat them right up. Because if people take the time to leave a review, then they know, hey, this is a really good podcast and we should show it to more people. You can also leave a comment on Spotify on what you thought about this episode in particular, which is always fun to read. I really appreciate any time you do that. And it is also a little algorithm god offering. So go ahead and do that. You can also support For the Love of History podcast and get some goodies and more history goodness by joining us over on Patreon. The new FX Shogun series is out and I'm fully obsessed with it. And I have been doing some reaction videos that are over on YouTube. If you haven't joined us over on YouTube, please join us over on YouTube. But the extended version is on Patreon, as well as some bonus content, some behind the scenes about the new Shogun series. And for the season finale of the Shogun series, we're going to do a live watch party. So if you're over on Patreon, you'll know about it. And we also do once a month a live cooking shows over on Patreon, and so you can get the recipe list and so many other cool, fun history goodies over there, and you can join us at just $2 a month, and I cannot even tell you how much that helps the podcast and helps me keep the podcast going and keep it growing and getting better and better each week. And a very special thank you goes to our Patreon members like Emily, Shayna, April, M, Shinifer, Jamie, Jordan, Laurel, Lauren, Sarah, and Lauren. Your support means the world to me, and I appreciate every single one of you wonderful, delicious donuts. Oh, and don't forget, you can also get some merch, and we can be twins in our official For the Love of History matching merch. Okay, and with all of that out of the way, thank you so much for joining us here today and every Friday. And before we go, I want to remind you to do something that makes you happy. Take a little sippy sip of your water. Please don't forget to drink your water. It makes a world of a difference. Go outside, touch some grass, eat some food if you haven't. Whatever it is, make sure you're taking care of yourself and your body, because I love you. And I only want the best. So with that, I will see you next week when we talk about the ridiculously long history of pancakes. I can't wait. Okay, love you. See you later. Bye.
Why is there a metronome right now? Okay.
What did it take to survive an ancient siege?
Why was the cult of Dionysus behind so many slave revolts in ancient Rome?
What's the tragic history and mythology behind Japan's most haunted ancient forest?
We're Jen.
And Jenny.
From Ancient History Fangirl. Join us to explore ancient history and mythology from a fun, sometimes tipsy perspective.
Find us at ancienthistoryfangirl.com or wherever you get your podcasts.